I'll say good morning to you now, brethren. The reason I say it now is because there are more of you here now. Can everyone hear me? Because I'm usually accused of talking to myself up here. Well, 2 days ago, at the opening of our convention, we had the privilege and pleasure to welcome you to our convention. Of course, not all of you were here at that time, and that was because of some circumstances that you know of, and we don't need to know. But we would like to extend our welcome to you now. We appreciate your participation, your response to our invitation. And as you notice on our program, we still have the whole day today, and we have approximately 6 hours tomorrow. And so that means that there will be some spiritual nourishment and fellowship for you for the balance of this convention. It was at the opening of our convention when Brother Brent gave the first discourse, and he gave us a discourse which should be very helpful to us during our endeavor to be faithful unto the Lord, make our calling election sure. And that was the wisdom of the wise. And I think that you certainly appreciated that discourse. Today, he has a different subject, of course, the title of which is Prove the Things That Differ.
Thank you, Brother Herman, and good morning, dear brethren. And for those of you who were not here at the opening of the convention, I would like to bring to you the Christian loving greetings of your brethren from the Duncan, British Columbia, Canada Ecclesia. Our lesson for this morning we entitle Proving the Things That Differ, or if you please, simpler, Examining the Things That Differ. Our theme text is taken from the Epistle of Paul to the church at Philippi in the first chapter, and we are going to be reading verses 9 and 10. Paul prayed for the brethren, verse 9, that your love may abound yet more and more in knowledge and in all judgment, that ye may approve the things that are excellent, and that ye may be sincere and without offense until the day of Christ. Properly translated, Paul prayed for us that our love may yet abound more and more in knowledge and all judgment, that you may prove or examine the things that differ, that you may be pure and without offense unto the day of Christ. Paul is saying that our love is to increase, our love is to grow in our knowledge and in our judgment, such that we may be able to prove, to test, to examine the things that differ. And in our lesson this morning, brethren, we would like to consider Paul's words here and try and consider to prove, to test, or to examine some of the things that differ between you and I, between us as brethren as a whole. And by these differences, we mean differences not only on doctrine, but differences also with regard to attitude on doctrinal differences. Since the passing of our pastor, There has been no small trial amongst the Bible students as a whole with regard to attaining and maintaining the proper equilibrium and balance with regard to the present truth message. There is now no recognized, divinely appointed spokesman, no final arbiter on conflict and controversy. There is no one for us to go to as the final word, as it were, upon each of the issues that come up. And it's probably not too much different than the lesson that is given to us in Proverbs, the 29th chapter, verse 18. This proverb reads, Proverbs 29, verse 18, that where there is no vision, my people perish. This is a pathetic and anemic translation in the King James translation. Properly, it should read that without a revelation by prophecy, a people become ungovernable. And this was very true of Israel of old. In the absence of a prophet or a messenger of God, the people of Israel fell into all manner of perils. In 1 Samuel, the 3rd chapter, verse 1, we are told of an instance in the time of Eli, where the word of the Lord was rare and that there was no clear vision spread abroad amongst the people of Israel. And the children of Israel were sorely affected by the lack of a prophet present at that time, even to the point where the priesthood fell into immorality and lack of respect for the word of the Lord. Now, with the passing of the pastor, we have not lost a prophet, but we have lost a divinely appointed interpreter of prophecy, and indeed the interpreter of the whole counsel of God. And with no recognized authority, our ranks from the pastor's death to our day are divided. As many go their several ways. And so, brethren, we believe it's important for us to examine the things that differ. In the scope of 45 minutes, we're hardly going to be able to do justice to a lesson as involved and as complex as this. Really, what we intend to do is narrow our focus and try and just consider a few general principles. And it's up for you to determine whether they're worthy for application or not. We would like to consider a few of our differences with regard to doctrine, but more particularly, differences between attitude on doctrinal differences. And at the outset, let me say, brethren, that I have not personally been through the heat of the battle, of many of the doctrinal battles that many of you here have been. So I hope that this is not thought of as being presumptuous, that I should tell you who have been, many of you who have been through battles, large and small, much more than have I, of how we ought to behave in the midst of these things. But rather, we hope together this morning to be able to, as we said, just consider a few basic principles and see if they do not have some application with regard to some of the problems that we face today. At the outset, let me set a premise, a basis, brethren. I am a very large believer in fidelity to the harvest message as presented in the 6 volumes of the pastor's writings. I believe the pastor is the wise and faithful servant. And I believe that if the Lord would call an individual wise and faithful, that I would want to pay very close attention to what he had to say. And I believe that he was the instrument used of the Lord to present to us at this end of the age, the meet and due season, the harvest message. This lesson is been put together in part, brethren, because we have been concerned over, in the past some months and the past few years, of some of the attitudes that we've seen developing amongst some of our brethren. We have, in fellowship, and have heard this from discourses, we have heard things said from brethren we feel that reflects a undue hardening, narrowing of focus and attention on what fidelity to the truth and harvest message really means. We believe that fidelity to the harvest message does not mean a subscription to a given set of doctrinal precepts, but also includes a grasp, an apprehension, and an application of the spirit that the pastor tried to inculcate to us, contained in his writings of the harvest message. We have heard from some of our brethren in discourses and in fellowship that if you attend a mixed convention with those with whom we do not regularly meet, those with whom we may not see eye to eye on with regard to prophetic matters of this end of the age, it has been said to me directly, and I've heard it from the platform, that you are jeopardizing the spiritual well-being of your new creature. It has been pointed out by some that if you attend a convention such as the International Convention held, what, every 2 years in Europe, that if you attend there, your mere attendance may jeopardize your relationship with the Lord. And brethren, this is part of the impetus of putting this lesson together. I believe that that is an error of the first magnitude, and I'm seriously concerned for the well-being of the brethren who would inculcate such an attitude. Brethren, let's consider for a moment. Let's examine some of the differences by taking what we think is a bit of an extreme position and just applying the principles involved from this extreme position. Let me pose a question to you and then hopefully bring that down to something a little more tangible to each and every one of us. Would you, brethren, attend a nominal church service if you thought that you could do some good in witnessing to the truth there? And if you were to say yes, that you would attend a nominal church service if you thought that you could do some that gathering, would you, if you went there on a given Sunday, and unbeknownst to you before that you had gone there, unknown to you, that they were going to be serving the communion emblems, and there you sat, and the emblems were passed around, and the emblems came to you, would you partake? And a third phase to this, brethren. If an elder in your ecclesia attended a nominal church service and unknown to him beforehand they were serving the communion emblems at that church, unknown to him, and the plate came to him, or however they dispense of the emblems, and he partook, and you found out about it, and some months later it came election time, would you vote for him or would you not vote for him? Now, brethren, it's sobering, but adapt these principles to attending a convention or a mixed convention, let us say, a convention of those brethren with whom we do not see eye to eye on some aspects of the harvest message. Would you attend that convention? Do you think that it would be proper for you to be there? Or do you believe that your being there means that you accept and sanction the views that may either be presented from the platform or represented from the platform, whether they be spoken or not? Do you believe that your attendance there means that you denigrate or minimize the importance of harvest truths? Or do you believe that your presence there would signal a lack of appreciation of truth and could possibly stumble some of your brethren, perhaps some of the younger brethren, who may not be yet established to have a firm convictions of their own with regard to proper practice? We believe that, in part, brethren, at least, we can offer some suggestions for the latter by considering the former, by considering attendance at a nominal church service in comparison to attendance at a convention with those with whom we may not see eye to eye with. And in that regard, I would like to read an article from the pastor, an answer to a question under the heading Interesting Questions Answered, in reprint 2766. Reprint 2766. The pastor was asked about the propriety of attending a nominal church service, and we would like to read his answer in entirety, lest we draw a mere excerpt and do injustice to it, brethren. Question: would it be proper for us, after withdrawing from a church, to return to it and commune with it? The answer: there is no law to hinder the Christian from going anywhere he believes that the Lord would have him go, and where he believes he can get and do good and serve the truth and feed the Lord's flock and use his influence to the Lord's praise. If therefore you feel that your visiting the church from which you have withdrawn would have the above beneficial results, and if you would be made welcome by the said church, we see no reason why you might not, as occasion would offer, attend such a church. However, on the other hand, there is something to be said. Are you sure that your going would either do good or bring good? Are you sure that your influence would be favorable to the truth if invested in that matter? Or would it be unfavorable to the truth and favorable to error? Are you sure that your attendance would furnish any opportunity for speaking the truth and serving it to fellow members of the household of faith? These are questions which each of the Lord's people must decide for them for himself. We think that as the general rule, denominational lines are so closely drawn that there is no opportunity inside of them for bringing the truth clearly and fearlessly before the attention of the attendants. Respecting the taking of communion, it would seem to us to do this regularly would be certainly unwise and prejudicial to the truth, because it would be favoring what we think is not scriptural. And yet, if by accident we happen to be with a Christian people when they partook of the communion, we would not feel condemned by our conscience in celebrating the Lord's death with them, explaining subsequently to our acquaintances what we consider to be the scriptural truth on the subject. But in visiting a nominal church, we should, if possible, avoid visiting on the Sunday when they erroneously celebrate the Lord's death out of its memorial season. End of quote. Now, brethren, I personally believe that the pastor would not be well pleased if we were to quote him as the end-all, be-all in our answers as to the manner in how we would conduct ourselves. But I use this reprint article because I think it's significant. In so much as I have asked the questions that I posed you earlier of a number of brethren in personal fellowship with whom I know do not agree with this concept of attendance of a nominal church, much less partaking of the memorial emblems there, which, as the pastor says, brethren, is a matter of conscience. And I might say I'm not encouraging going to a nominal church and partaking of their emblems. It's a matter of conscience. I couldn't do it. My conscience wouldn't allow me. But I have asked the brethren those questions about attendance, partaking of the emblems, would they vote for an elder? And, you know, as a general rule of thumb, and I don't want to be too harsh on some of my brethren who strive so diligently for fidelity as they understand it, but those who are the self-professed greatest proponents and defendants of the truth are often the most vehement against what the pastor has said here. And I think that's significant in suggesting that fidelity to doctrine is one thing, but a fidelity to an understanding, a capturing of the spirit that the pastor tried to inculcate with regard to the present truth message, I think has been missed by some of our brethren. It's maybe somewhat of a crude analogy, brethren, but considering the scope of the error in which the nominal systems at large are covered in contrast to what we would consider some of the errors of those with whom we do not agree, and finding that the pastor himself said that he could attend such a service, even though, given their tremendous errors in which they were found themselves befuddled in, I think the principles are important and suggest to us that he did not feel mere attendance would mean that he embraced the thoughts represented or presented from the platform, nor would it mean a minimizing of his fidelity to the truth. And neither, evidently, from his words, did he feel that it would mean an adverse influence upon those brethren who would observe his act. And I think, brethren, those principles translate over into the attitude and spirit towards our brethren with whom we may not see eye to eye with. Let us consider, brethren, some scriptural principles that I think tell us something about our dealing with our brethren with whom we do not see eye to eye on. Let us turn in our Bibles to Romans, the 14th chapter. Romans, the 14th chapter. In this chapter, we have a very powerful lesson from the pen of the Apostle Paul, which again the King James translation butchers badly. But let's have a look at a few verses from this chapter and try and consider what Paul is trying to tell us here. Romans, the 14th chapter, beginning with the first verse and reading on down through the first several verses. Him that is weak in the faith receive ye, but not to doubtful disputations. This verse, brethren, should the thought that is the Apostle Paul is trying to convey here is that he that you consider to be weak in faith, one whose practice and beliefs you consider to be wrong, and henceforth you think of him as weak in the faith, he says, receive him. Receive him to fellowship, but not for the purpose of doubtful disputations. And the thought behind this is, don't receive him. Don't get together with him in fellowship so that you can badger him about his doubts, about what you consider his doubtful thoughts. Don't dispute over these doubtful thoughts. Don't try and hit him over the head as a means of changing his points of view. Let's read on and we'll see exactly what Paul has reference to and see if we cannot lift some principles out of the situation in which Paul is addressing. Verse 2 and on. He says, "For one believes that he may eat all things. Another who is weak eateth herbs. Let not him that eateth despise him that eateth not. And let not him that eateth not judge him that eateth, for God hath received him." God has taken him into fellowship. As you are asked to take him into fellowship, it's the same word, receive, in verse 1 as it is here in verse 3. So here we have the principles identified for us, the strong and the weak. The strong is the one who says, "I know I can eat all these things. It makes no difference." And the weak is the one who eats herbs only and who says, "Well, I must restrict my diet, and this is true and important." But note in verse 3, the gist of this is both sides believe they're right. The weak doesn't think that he's weak. The weak thinks he's strong and the other one's weak. And the strong certainly thinks he's strong and the other one's weak. But he tells us here, not the one is not to despise the other, and the other is not to judge the other. "Who art thou that thou judges another man's servant?" Picturing the individual as the Lord's servant. The Lord is the judge. We are not the judge of our brethren. "And to his own master he stands or he falls. Yea, he shall be holden up, for God is able to make him stand. One man esteems a day above another. Another esteems every day alike. Let every man be fully persuaded in his own mind." Let every man be persuaded in his own mind. Brethren, what an important and profound concept. And talking of the spirit that the pastor tried to inculcate to us in the harvest message, volume 6, page 326 to 328, he lifts this verse, this portion of the fifth verse out of Romans 14:5, "Let every man be fully persuaded in his own mind." And those three pages discusses in some detail our attitude amongst us as brethren. How it is that on the fundamentals we must demand harmony, but on the lesser issues we should extend liberality and understanding. Volume 6, pages 326 and 28. And we leave those verses, brethren, for your own consideration. Those pages, rather. In this chapter of Romans 14, Paul tries to encourage us, the 19th verse, to follow after the things that make for peace and wherewith we may edify one another. One of my favorite texts of scriptures on this, as we're going to come to this a little later, is the last verse, and I think it's the 18th verse in James, the third chapter, that talks about the importance of peace. That with, James says, with a climate of peace between us, it is the climate with which we can encourage the greatest possible fruitage of a harvest of righteousness, the greatest possible growth. And brethren, in saying this, we are not saying peace at any cost, peace at the abandonment of principle. It's, I believe, a very sad truth that sometimes divisions have been necessary. Ecclesias have gotten to a point where simply no longer could they get together and study for mutual edification. But I think it's a very, very sad statement. Paul tells us in verse 21, it's neither good to eat flesh, nor to drink wine, or do anything whereby your brethren would be stumbled or made weak. If you are of the strong, and you feel a liberty to do that which a weak one says, no, you don't have the liberty to do, he says, don't do it. Don't stumble him. It may be a crude analogy, brethren, but lift the principle out from these verses and consider. You may feel the liberality to go to conventions that another one may not feel the liberality to go to. You may consider yourself strong and consider the other one weak. This verse tells us, don't do anything that would stumble the weak. Does that then suggest, in contrast to, I think, the example that the pastor was giving us in his stated willingness to attend a church service, that then, because the brethren believe that we shouldn't go, that we should not go because it might stumble them? That's a searching question, and one that each and every one of us must weigh according to the situation and the individuals at hand. But I believe, brethren, there is an example given for us in Acts, the 21st chapter, that tells us in Paul's own actions that sometimes actions need to be taken that could cause the possibility of some stumbling on others. In Acts, the 21st chapter, of course, is the recorded instance of the Apostle Paul returning from his third missionary trip and arriving, and we're looking at the last half of the chapter, beginning around verse 20 and on, really. He arrived in Jerusalem, and there the assembled elders and leaders encouraged Paul to take upon himself the rite of purification in the temple, which we believe was the rite of purification with regard to the Nazarite vow. Now, they encouraged him to do this because they said, some of the Jewish community are saying that you are teaching against the law. And you do this thing, Paul, and it will be a witness to them that you, as a Jew, are not trying to condemn or say the law is evil and wrong. Now, Paul agreed to go along with this action. And Paul went through the rite of purification with these, I believe it was four men, in the temple. Now, brethren, if you stop and consider the Apostle Paul's actions in this situation, first and foremost, we say we believe his actions were right and proper. No question about that. But we think there is a gray area in this. The pastor has suggested as much in reprint 3188, that because of the law issue and that raging controversy in the early church of whether the Gentiles should be enjoined to subscribe to the tenets of the law, over the raging issue of the law controversy, that Paul would go into the temple and follow through with this rite of purification could possibly have been used by some of the brethren in the early church, perhaps some of the Judaizers in particular, to point up that his actions were wrong, and he is saying, look, I am going in here. It signals that it's fine, that it's all right. Paul really was going back into the system which the Lord had cast off and rejected, and out of which he had called his people. There could have been, brethren, some stumbling of those over Paul's actions. But he determined that the greatest good accomplished was by following this action. And I think, brethren, this demonstrates the principles that sometimes, even though some may be in danger of being somewhat stumbled by actions we may take, sometimes the greatest good is served by following through with those actions and hoping and prayerfully considering and discussing with the individual so that they will not be stumbled. Brethren, let's turn in our Bibles to James, the third chapter. We are believers, brethren, and I feel confident you would echo the same sentiments. But regardless of what position we take on doctrine and even in our attitudes of where we draw the line, that we will never want to allow ourselves to become strifeful and embittered towards our brethren, and to allow an improper spirit to jeopardize our spiritual equilibrium or the opportunity of communicating with our brethren for their benefit. In James, the third chapter, verses 13 and on to the end of the chapter, we read, "Who is a wise man and endued with knowledge among you?" Properly translated, "Who is wise and understanding among you?" He says, if you are wise and understanding, he says, you will show it out of a good conversation or conduct, this means, by works with meekness of wisdom. Now, the preceding context of this is the Apostle James has been talking about the tongue and the great danger of the tongue. He says, if you are truly wise, you will, and have understanding, you will show it out of a good life, a good conduct, with works of meekness and wisdom, not with a bitter tongue that issues forth, as he says in the preceding verse, with strife and causing trouble amongst the brethren. He says, but if you have bitter envying and strife in your hearts, glory not and lie not against the truth. Brethren, sometimes we lose that sense of balance and equilibrium in our conflicts with our brethren with whom we do not see eye to eye. Sometimes we have seen bitterness and entirely the wrong attitude creep in. And if this happens, brethren, we must remember the 15th and 16th verses. He says that this wisdom which is of strife and contention, he says, is not from above, but is earthly, sensual, and devilish. The three great foes of the new creation. If we are confrontational with our brethren, antagonistic, we've lost that battle. And that wisdom is from the earth. It is sensual. The world, the flesh, and the devil have won the victory in that regard. Because he says, where there is envying and strife, where there is this contention between us, he says there is confusion and every evil work. The Greek word for confusion, properly translated, according to the Rotherham translation, is, where there is envying and strife between us, there is anarchy. Anarchy and every evil work. Anarchy of brethren pulling apart rather than pulling together. Rather than coming together for mutual edification and strengthening of one another in our consecration ideals and resolve, determination. There is anarchy of pulling brethren apart. But rather, he says, in contrast to the wisdom from below, the wisdom that is from above is first pure. It is not tainted with this strife and contentious spirit. He says it's peaceable, it's gentle, and it's easily entreated. Oh, brethren, what a beautiful thought. It is easy to be entreated, this wisdom that is from above. It is willing to listen. It is willing to communicate, willing to share with the one with another. It is full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. And the fruit, verse 18, of righteousness is sown in peace of them that make peace. The harvest of righteousness is sown in peace by them that make peace. And as we said earlier, brethren, to develop the true fruitage harvest of righteousness between us, we need that climate of peace and understanding. Our time is rapidly getting away on us. In all of this, we restate again, brethren, we are dealing with a complex subject, an involved subject, and we do not mean in reading these verses to suggest that we should throw a blanket of liberality over all of our doctrinal conflicts between us. If we saw an anything goes liberal, overly liberal attitude amongst the brethren, I hope I would be standing up here encouraging you to a more conservative approach and fidelity to truth and the harvest message. But amongst some of our brethren, I am concerned. And I worry for their well-being in their attitudes, which I can only say, in my opinion, I believe to be wrong. And so we are addressing ourselves in this, brethren, in primary concern to the wrong attitude towards our brethren. We all may very well profess that we love our brethren, but you know, that beautiful chapter in 1 Corinthians, the 12th chapter, that tells us about the function of the body. We're members in particular. Each and every one of you have a role to play. And that role does not mean you're independent from others. It means you have something to give to the others. If we say to our brethren, I'm not going to fellowship with you, and we get together and we can't so much as even talk the scriptures, I think there's a danger in that, brethren, of coming awfully close to the message of 1 Corinthians, the 12th chapter, where the eye says to the ears, is it that I have no need of you? Or the hand to the foot, and I've forgotten the exact correspondency, brethren, but of the one part of the body saying to the other, I have no need of you. Brethren, none of us can allow ourselves to think in terms that our spiritual perspective is all-encompassing, or that our spiritual growth is independent of our brethren. We need our brethren. And unless we believe that our brethren are really not brethren, have been cast off by the Lord, I believe we have a responsibility to those brethren to try and encourage them, not only in their understanding of fidelity to the harvest message in its doctrinal precepts, but to encourage them in their consecrations. And how can we do that if we don't exchange with them on spiritual matters? We must be very careful, brethren, to avoid the error, and I fear to say the hypocrisy, of the Pharisees. The parable of the unjust steward was a reproof from our Lord towards the attitude of the scribes and Pharisees, the religious rulers of Israel. He said, behold this steward who had much more wisdom than you. And the crux of the lesson really was that the scribes and Pharisees were demanding too much of the people. They were putting onerous burdens upon them that the people could not live up to. And they themselves really couldn't live up to them. In that much, they were hypocrites. And it really ties into, and we don't have time to go into this, the lesson of Matthew, the 23rd chapter, the 21st verse. The Lord told them, the scribes and Pharisees, yes, there are legitimate areas where you are to demand from them the strictures of law, but don't forget the truth and the mercy and walking humbly with God. Don't forget these things, the love of God. And Jesus was quoting from the Old Testament in that particular instance. Brethren, I heard a discourse some time ago. That used 2 Timothy, the 3rd chapter, verses 1 to 7, that speak of perilous times in the last days, and applied those verses to the brethren. I leave that for your own consideration, your own reading. We don't have time to get into it now. But I take very great exception to the application of those verses to the brethren. I find no reference to the pastor in the pastor's writings, other than, I believe it was a letter sent to him by someone else who used these verses in reference to the brethren. I find no reference from the pastor in applying these verses to the brethren. And I take great exception to those who would use verses like these that speak so dramatically and drastically of immoralities and a lack of love of God towards those who don't agree with them in doctrine and precept. I think it's a wrong spirit, brethren. Our time has come to a close, brethren, and there's a lot of material we would very much like to get to, and yet we have no time. Brethren, let us be set for the defense of the gospel in its full scope. Let us not narrow our focus and try and think that our opinions should be the fixed views of others. Let us never write off our brethren, because we all have a role and a function to play. And we would like to close by the use of Ephesians, the 4th chapter, reading verses 15 and 16 from the Dialogue translation. In the context, Paul here has been telling us how that there are apostles, prophets, evangelists, shepherds, teachers, for the edification of the church. And he tells us in the 15th verse that we are to be truthful in love, that we may grow up in all things into him who is the head, the anointed one, from whom the whole body, being fitly joined and united by means of every assisting joint, according to the proportionate energy of each single part, affects the growth of the body for the building up of itself in love. Paul laid down his life for the brethren. How great is our energy, brethren? Each single part, proportionate energy, affects the growth of the body for the building of itself up in love. Brethren, we pray the Lord's blessing upon our thoughts this morning, and we thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Brother Brent. I'm sure that you will feel the same as I do right now, that if Brother Brent had another 15 minutes, you would appreciate that. But we have to go according to the program. However, before I express my appreciation for Brother Brent's thoughts, my conscience tells me that I should apologize to him and to you for the disruption we had here. I do not know why it was necessary. It appeared to me that perhaps, since they worked on a microphone, that some in the back could not hear. I could hear very well down here. So not knowing the reason and circumstances for it, I would assume that it was necessary. But I would suggest to all the following speakers that come up here that they adjust their own microphone, because it doesn't look well when somebody climbs up on the stage to adjust the microphone. It's quite easy to do it for yourself. Make a little noise, but you can bear that. Now, the title that Brother Brent had for his discourse was To Prove the Things That Differ. I think we're quite familiar with the subject that he had. There are quite a few differences among the brethren. Not only that, but there are a great many differences in the world today, politically, financially, and religiously. And they are all coming out into the light. They're being proved. The world is learning the corruption that is in the world, which will be the motivation later on for total anarchy. That must be my hearing aid, I think. Shut it off. Reminds me of Brother Coleman. When you get older, you lose your sight, you lose your hearing, you lose your voice, practically. But it wasn't my hearing aid, it was something else. At any rate, I think it was a wonderful discourse that Brother Brent gave. It was very timely, very necessary. And the differences that he spoke of is only a very small part of all of it. And I think it's very necessary that someone would have the courage, as he had it, to bring it out into the open. So that the brethren, the Lord's sheep, would not go astray with some of the differences that are not the harvest message. So we wish to express our very much appreciation for Brother Brent's thoughts. And now let us close with hymn number 23, which is his choice, and then Brother Brent will close with prayer.
Thank you. in heaven, we humbly bow in your presence to honor and to thank you, dear Father. Help us, dear Lord, to seek fidelity to the message of truth, to walk humbly before you and to seek your guidance and counsel. We pray your blessing and overruling upon the word spoken, forgiveness of anything said amiss. We pray that you would further continue to bless us this day as we anticipate the joys of convention and realize our need of one another and our need of the encouragement that we find here. Bless us as we wait before you and accept our humble thanks. Through Jesus we pray. Amen.